Good evening, everyone. Happy Friday. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, one of my friends, the big guy, is with me tonight from North Carolina. Jeff Crawford is a suspense and supernatural author. His books are so well written that after I read them, I have to go and decompress for a couple days because they're that good. They're such a visceral effect on me when I read his books, and I know it will be the same way for you. He's just finished up probably what is considered his best work called Fields of Ghosts. I'm very happy to welcome back to Authors on the Air my pal, the big guy, Jeff Crawford. Jeff, welcome back to Authors on the Air.
Pam, it's my pleasure, and I can't think of any place I'd rather be.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I know that you are in North Carolina, and you're a little bit in, kind of out in the country there, so we may fade in and out, but stay close to your phone if you can, please, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So, first of all, how's hunting and fishing going for you?
It's going great when I have time to do it. I actually did a little more of it this past winter than I had been, and I enjoyed every minute that I was out there.
Okay, and there's a new baby in the Crawford family, isn't there?
There is. I have a new great-nephew. They swear his name's Benjamin, but I call him Buford. And he's going to be all right. As soon as I can get him to grow a beard and put on some camouflage, he'll be just fine.
There you go. And he's only, what, like 6 months old now or something?
Five months or something like that. But he's already wearing University of Florida T-shirt, so he'll be a fine.
Well, and I like him already anyway. You know, you and I do this back and forth thing with University of Florida, even though one of my brothers did his undergraduate and graduate degree there. I just refuse to admit that, you know, the alligators are that far north from where I live, so we'll let it go at that. You know, I seem to recall that you started on this book as soon as you finished the last one, and you did it, you jumped on it right away, but this book has really taken you a lot longer to write than any of the other books you've written, so far as I can remember.
Exactly.
Is that right? Yeah.
Exactly
this
right.
one, this one was the book that you really... I mean, you got into this one immediately, but this one, it's a big book. Not that your other ones aren't either, but it's a big book, and it's got a lot of really deep stuff in it. Tell me about it, and tell me why, and I know you've already started your next book, too, but let's talk specifically about Field of Ghosts, because I love that title.
Fields of Ghosts was something that I started thinking about a month before I finished Velvet Eyes. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. I just had the idea. I said, what if there was a leper colony that somehow got manipulated, used, bastardized, and then refined over the years until it actually became basically a Shanghai or a white slavery ring, because eventually, you know, the original inhabitants were going to die off. And I thought, okay, that's kind of a neat something to work with. I just wasn't sure I could ever make a book out of it. So I started fooling around. And I said, well, we got to get in there somehow in modern time. And I decided to let a couple that was already having some troubles just sort of fall into it. No fault of their own, but they did. And the reason I did that is because I wanted them to be in a situation where the only two people that they could trust was going to be each other, and they didn't particularly like each other. So I said, if I could do that, then I can add an element of suspense without a whole lot of work. So all I had to do was develop the characters and why they were there, and then develop the peripheral characters that were going to you know, be playing parts. And I said, well, okay, you know, so I got to about 85 or 90,000 words, and it sort of, I was ready to tag out. and I wasn't sure it was going to do anything. And then, you know, a couple of days later, the light bulb came on. I said, this is where you go. And because I didn't want to write the average novel, which is 90,000 words. I wanted to give, if somebody's going to buy my book, I wanted to give them their money's worth, and I wanted to not rush the story. So I kept writing and kept writing, and it finally wound up at, I think it was 136,500 words.
Jeez, it's a huge book.
Yeah, it ended up taking 17 months to write.
Yeah, this was not your average book for sure. You know, I remember when you and I first met, you had just finished your first one, and so I want to ask you, from when you wrote With Sympathy for Job, how have you seen your writing change now that you've finished Fields of Ghosts?
The patience level has gone from about 10 to about 10,000. I have learned to be extremely patient and not rush to what I know is going to be a good page, even if it's going to take me 8 pages to get to it. I have learned that 500 good words a day is a whole lot better than 1,500 just words. That was a real revelation. And I have learned since that first book how to write thought processes better. I can write what somebody's thinking, why they're thinking it, and have them do that while somebody is sitting across the table from them and not know what's going on in that person's mind.
Interesting.
And once I learned how to do that, then it got real fun for me to do.
You know, Jeff, we talked before, and this was a while ago, about when you're writing, because you really are, at your heart of it all, a storyteller. And I think that, don't you believe that just your history and your family, your community, lends itself to being, it's generational and cultural, but you are storytellers, first of all. That is how family histories are passed. That is how entertainment is done. Do you think that being a storyteller has helped you to put your writing in perspective?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up where... that's how you
I'm losing
the
you. There you
stories.
Go. There you go. I was losing you there.
Okay, that's how we pass the time with telling stories, or that's how we amuse ourselves. Or, like you said, we pass down family history. There's a real long episode in the second book, The Betrayal, where the lady's telling a ghost story, and it wasn't made up. That's something that I've known since I was 4 years old. That was a true story through my family. So storytelling is as natural as falling off a log to me.
Yeah.
Once I learned how to write it, you know, it's easy to sit there and tell a story in 5 minutes. It's a whole lot different to try to write it over a period of 2 or 3 days and make sure it's exactly where it doesn't come out as like an essay, but you're hearing it as a conversation.
So let me ask you this, because the generational and cultural dynamic is telling stories, is speaking stories. When you're writing, and like you said, you have to take that one dialogue and put it into 8 pages so it's conversational, it's not like an essay. Do you ever read out loud what you've written to see how it sounds to your ear, if the nuance and the cadence of the voices are where you want them to be and how you remember them?
Absolutely. I actually will have conversations out loud before I ever write it and actually speak it out like if you were an actor reading lines, and to see if that sounds plausible, see if it sounds interesting, see if it sounds funny or scary as hell or whatever I'm trying for.
Right.
And if it works, then I'll write it, and then the next day I go back and I read it again, and I'll tweak it or change it or add a word or this or that. And that's
right.
how I do that. But there is a, if you can, if you're hanging around the outside of my house, you would think, okay, there's a nut job lives in there. Because he just sits in there and talks to himself while his Zen music is playing. And that's how I do that. You know, I zone everything out for about 2 hours and I wrestle with this thing, and then, you know, it's time for the Braves to play or something. So I turn it off. But, I have a lot of out loud conversations with my characters.
It's interesting. And yet, while your characters are strong, it's your storytelling, it's your narrative and prose, I think that truly make your books what they are. That's why they're so special. Because I don't know how to say this the right way. So, because your characters are great characters, don't get me wrong, but I think that your characters might be telling you what they're doing, but in essence, your characters are telling the story. And so your story is very, very strong. Whereas I'm feeling what your characters are feeling because they're immersed in this story. Does that make sense to you? Do you know what I'm
yes,
trying to
does.
Say? Your
yeah,
narrative is great. I mean, you could name your character whatever you wanted to, and it would be okay because it's the story being told around those characters that I think is the strength in your books. At least I found it to be for myself.
Well, thank you. That's exactly what I
try for. I don't want to tell a story and every other line say, well, you know,
Joe Blow
did this at this point. I don't want to do that. I want Joe Blow to tell you what he did.
And
tell you why he did it and what he was thinking when he did it. So having them tell the story, because you've talked to enough writers, you know that they take on a life of their own, and half of the time they do things that I was never expecting them to do.
Sure.
And people that don't write
or don't
mess with this kind of
field
as much as writers and interviewers and publishers do, they don't understand that. But a lot of the time, I have no idea what those characters are going to do until it happens.
Right, but they get sucked into the story, right?
A perfect instance is the end of that book.
Hold on one second, Jeff.
I knew how that book was going to end.
Hold on one second. I just want to let everybody know, Jeff lives in, I don't want to say in a remote area, but in an area in North Carolina where there's not a lot of cell service. So if you're having difficult time hearing, I'm sorry, Jeff and I always have problems communicating unless he's like down in the flatland someplace, right? It just you don't get really good cell service. So if you want, I can try calling you back and see if we can't clear up the sound a little bit. Would that work for you? And we'll just take
a
little break right here. Okay, let me call you right back. I'll call you at the same number. Okay?
Okay.
All right. We're going to take just a short break while I get Jeff on the line. And thank you for being so patient. Sometimes we just don't have a great connection, but we have a great author, and so that's what's important. So
let's try it again.
Oh, there you go. You are crystal now. Very good. Very good. Thank you. So we're talking about, you were saying you never know where what's going to happen because your characters have to actually point it out to you. And I'm thinking to myself, because your characters know, they don't know where they're going because they're so involved in the story. How will you know until they actually, whatever's going to happen, happens to them. They're not creating the mystery or the suspense. It's the story is creating it for them, which is so different from writers in your genre. And I think it's more powerful. Because truly, I'm on edge when I read your books. I can't even know which way a character is thinking because you don't know what's coming at them next. Is that right?
Yeah, because half the time I don't know, and it is indescribably fun for me to surprise myself and every reader with what happens. I'll give you a perfect example. This new book, Fields of Ghosts, was the first one that I didn't self-publish. It got picked up by a publishing company, by a wonderful publisher named Robin Tidwell out in Missouri.
Congratulations.
She read the book, and she called me or texted me right after she finished it, like 5 minutes afterwards, and she said, "What in the heck happened at the end? You got to tell me." And I said, "No, I don't." I said, "It's up to the reader." And she said, "You're going to make every reader you've got mad at you if you don't tell me what happened." And I said, "No, I'm not telling you." I said, "That's up for you to decide." So I love to surprise people. I love to surprise myself. I love to surprise the characters.
I like those kind of endings because you start off with a premise, what if, and you end with the same premise. And
never thought of that.
Yeah, I like the fact that you don't spoon feed your reader all the answers. It's a brave and a wise writer, in my opinion, as a huge reader, and you know that. That I don't want someone to hold my hand and walk me through their book. I want them to let me have my own visuals about it. I want to imagine what the characters look like. I want to picture the location. So, and I think you're very intuitive on that level. That's why you don't give things away. And it does make the book incredibly suspenseful that way. So kudos to you, Jeff.
Well, thank you. I do that for a couple reasons. One, I think it's fun for the reader. And if they get mad or if they get happy or whatever, then I know they got emotionally invested, and that's what I'm after. But it's also fun for me. If I know exactly every – because, as you know, I'm not a plotter. I'm a pantser.
I know you are.
If I know every move it's going to make, it's no fun to write.
I want to just wind back a little bit for those of our listeners who've not heard you on the show before. You – just a little bit of background on what you do, please, and – explain at that school that you went to in the middle of Florida what you studied, and then I have a question I want to talk to you about afterwards. So tell everybody a little about your background.
Okay. I grew up in a really small community school until I was 10 years old, where the first 8 grades were all in the same school. I only went to one classroom every day. So it was real small. I only had one teacher, you know, for the first 4 years. In fact, my first grade teacher was the same teacher that my father had.
Wow.
So I moved to Florida, which was a huge awakening for me. I went to 4 different classrooms in one day in 5th grade, and I'd never done that before. And so I did that and went to a large high school, fairly large, graduating class of, I don't know, 200 people or something like that. And I didn't even know 200 people when I moved away from here. And, I did that, and I ended up cowboying for a living because that's what I'd always wanted to do. So I cowboyed for 3 or 4 years and did a lot of different things. And
to explain about the cattle and the name of the cattle, because it's so interesting to me. It's called tell me again.
The Charlet cattle?
Yeah, the Charlet cattle ranch in the South. It was the largest Charlet cattle ranch, and you were the youngest herdsman there, correct?
I was. When I was in high school, I got approached. I'd been horse farming for a year while I was in high school. I was running a horse farm for a man. I had 120 horses. And they came and approached me and asked me what I was doing after high school and offered me a job running their showstring and looking after their cattle herd. And so, I graduated on Friday night, and on Monday morning I was responsible for 1,800 head of cattle. And
wow.
It was a purebred
cattle ranch. They were a French breed, big white cattle. And so when I would go to the sale barn or I would go to Charlet meetings or whatever, everybody that had my job was 50, 60, 65 years old, and I was 16
wow.
and doing the same thing. So
wow.
that was kind of a feather in my cap, and we did that, and I moved on and did some thoroughbred farming and did the breeding and foaling for a horse farm, and worked in a movie once, did a couple of commercials for Purina, ended up working for a Purina store, and then we moved back to North Carolina after that, and I became interested in industrial management. And I went to college and got my degree in that. And I did that for 10 or 11 years, did some engineering. And then my father opened a factory of his own, a sewing factory, which is what he had always ran. And I was looking for a change, so I started doing that. And I've been production manager and vice president of that factory for a little over 22 years now.
So all along, where did your love of reading and writing come from? How did you work that into your life?
Before I ever went to school, I was reading. I always had books around the house. And a neighbor worked in the public library, and she brought me a discard book of Daniel Boone.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that thing cover to cover 15 or 20 times, and then I started reading more and more, and I never got out of that. I was like you. I read every book I could get my hands on.
Right.
Spent full days. I'd pack a lunch and spend a full day in the library once a week and do nothing but read from the time they opened until they closed. And I kept doing that, kept reading, and then I had they told me I was going to have surgery, and I was going to be, down for about 2.5 weeks. So I decided I was going to try to write a book. I had tried a lot of other little hobbies that, whether it was music or, hunting arrowheads or whatever, and I wasn't bored with it, but I was ready for something new. So I got a notebook and two packs of Ticonderoga pencils, and I set them beside my recliner, and when I got out of the hospital, I started messing around with it, and I wrote a book, and I thought, how does anybody write a long book? Because I wrote 26,000 words, and I was tapped. And then I wrote another one because I wanted to try to do it better, and it was longer, and it got a little better and a little more interesting, and then I wrote another one. And by the time I got to number 8, I had finally written a decent book, one that I thought was ready for public consumption. And we put it out, and then I had another one that was in the process while we were doing that, and I put it out 6 months later, 4 months later, and then another one that I was working on at the time, because all I did back then was write for 3 hours, 4 hours a night. And so all I did was work and write. There was no life to speak of. And so I ended up publishing 3 books in 1 year, which I'll never do that again. And then I wrote, if there's somebody out there wanting to get into writing, don't do that. That'll kill you. So then I wrote Through Black Velvet Eyes, which was a big departure from what I had been doing. And it got a little more lengthy and a little more involved, and I thought it was a better book. And then I got the bug to try to write a really good one and take my time. So I spent 17 months writing Fields of Ghosts, and it turned out I couldn't have made it any shorter, but as I look back, if I'd wanted to, I could have made it another 20,000 words longer if I'd
wow.
really wanted to, but I don't think I had to. I think I said everything I needed to say.
Right. So what, you got to leave them wanting. You got to leave your reader wanting. You can't just reveal it all and continue on and on and on. There has to be an ending somewhere. I find it also interesting that you play several different musical instruments. The reason I say that is because most of the authors that I speak to also are creative in other areas besides writing. What instruments do you play, Jeff?
I play flat top guitar, I play electric guitar, I play five string banjo, mandolin, dulcimer, chanter, harmonica a little bit, and piano some. And steel guitar. I play steel guitar.
Your family and your close friends are very involved in music. That's a real big part of your life, isn't it?
It is. It used to be huge, and then I got into the writing thing, but playing music was a big deal. A lot of people in my family play, a lot of friends play, and we would, you know, if it was, you know, you say, what are we going to do this weekend? Well, it would inevitably come around, well, let's just, you know, gather up somewhere and we'll play music. Sometimes that works out. Sometimes there's a story or two where it actually did some damage. But most of the time it's just a lot of fun, and we play everything from old gospel to bluegrass to Beatles music. You know, it's just whatever anybody's in the mood for.
Do you think that music helps your creative process when you're writing, or vice versa? Does writing help your musical creative process? Or are you are you tapping into kind of the same part of your brain and it's being fed with the creativity?
I don't think the writing helps the music, but the music definitely helps the writing in a lot of different ways.
Really? Share.
I can listen to, if I'm playing music and I play one of those really, really creepy old mountain bluegrass songs.
Right.
Then I can get into a real mood to write something really kind of dark in a book where I couldn't before. That music puts me in a mood to do that. I have also found that if I happen to get into a spot where I don't know what to do next in a book, I can pick up my fiddle or I can pick up a guitar and I can play for 20 or 25 minutes and the fog sort of lifts and I can go back to work.
It's interesting. But you write in a very solitary way, don't you?
Oh, God, yeah.
You
I cannot write if somebody else is in the room. I can't just write anywhere I want to, you know, sit down and do it. I have to sort of get into a... The best way to think about that is in my head there's a room, and I can go in that room and lock the door, and after about 5 minutes of winding down and getting in the mood, then I can write. But I can't do that anywhere else. But once I do that, I can put on the blinders, you know, click on the tunnel vision, and
sure,
that's all I do, and I can really lose myself in that for 45 minutes to 5 hours sometimes.
You write when you feel like writing. You don't manage your time. You don't manipulate it in any way. Isn't that true?
It is now. It is now. I used to do it religiously after work. I would come in, change clothes, grab a drink, see what was happening on the bottom of the ESPN board, and then sit down and write for 2.5 hours. I don't do that anymore. I wait until I have something worthwhile to write, or I won't do it. I'm not going to force it. It's no fun for me or the reader if I do that.
When you finish writing your first draft, do you do a lot of revisions?
No.
A lot of edits?
I do not. I'll tell you why I don't. The smartest man I ever heard talk about writing was Shelby Foote.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great loss to, you know, for him to have passed away 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was. He was an incredible man. And he wrote a 3-volume set on the Civil War, and it took him 27 years to write it. And he wrote it 500 words a morning with a dip pen, and then he would eat lunch, take a walk, and then he would come back and read it and type it. And once he had done that, he turned it down, the page down, and didn't touch it again until the next day. And he said, once I've written it, it's done. I'm not going to mess with it again, you know, except for, you know, the occasional comma or apostrophe or something that somebody's going to put in there. But as far as the words, he says, I'm finished. And that's sort of the way I've adapted. When I'll tell you, when I got Fields of Ghosts back from the publisher and she wanted me to look at it the last time, she said, make sure everything is exactly the way you want it. I read the entire book, 136,500 words, and I changed 3 words. So that told me that, okay, it was pretty clean when I sent it, and that was the way I wanted it. And she didn't argue with me. She said, hey, you're the writer. You do it the way you want to do it. And that's the way we did it.
I think that's pretty impressive because not a lot of authors trust that their words are going down on the page and that they're going to stay that way. A lot of times I talk to authors who say, I have the story, it's in a jumble, so I throw it on the page, and then when I start writing again, I go back and edit that first bit, and then I move on to the next just to keep myself in the moment. But you don't do that. You don't do that at all. You're totally, totally different. You are confident in what you've said and done, and I think that's marvelous. I love it.
The only thing I do is I'll go back and I'll read the last page that I did just to get myself back into a train of thought. But as far as changing it,
right.
No, I don't do that.
That's a good thing. That's a great thing. What's next on the agenda for you?
I'm 45,000 words into the new novel, which is going to be the darkest and probably the most introspective book I've tackled yet, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Is your style changing a little bit each time, Jeff?
My style, no, but my ability to do it better is changing every day.
Do you feel better as each new book comes along?
Oh, Lord, yeah. I would never have shopped any of the first 4 books out to a publisher because I knew they were just begging for a rejection letter.
Those were your training books, right?
Yeah. That's a good way to put that. I'll tell you a story about this last book that I did. I did a show with you probably know him, S. Evan Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good writer and he runs a really neat show. Well, I was going to do an interview with him when Velvet Eyes came out, and I got there late. I lost his number, and anyway, I scrambled, and I got there about 10 minutes late. And there was a lady talking when I got on there, and I didn't know there was going to be another guest. I don't know why, but I didn't know. So I got to listen to her for a long time, and then we talked back and forth during the interview, and we just sort of hit it off. And it turns out that it was, she was a writer. She'd done 4 or 5 books, and they were, you know, she's a really great writer. And they turned out she owned a publishing company. I sent her a message after we were done. It was nice meeting you, and you know, I thought you were interesting and funny. And we talked a little bit, and I said, I've got a book I'm going to finish in about 4 or 5 weeks, I think. I said, and I don't know exactly what I'm going to do with it. I said, I don't know what your submission process is, but I said, would you like to take a look at it? And she said, we're not taking submissions right now, but she said, if you'll send it to me, I'll read it personally, and let's see what happens. So I sent it to her, and, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks went by, and I gave her a call, and I said, have you read enough to know if you like it or hate it? And she said, I've read about half of it, and that's as far as I've gotten yet. I've been so busy. I said, okay. I'll call you in about 5 weeks, and we'll catch up and see what's going on then. She said, now forget that. She said, the book I know is just going to get better than what I've already written or read. She said, let me go ahead and email you a contract. She said, I love this book, and I can't wait to finish the rest of it. So the only time I've ever submitted a book, it only got read halfway through and got picked up. So that was good because I don't do well with rejection. So that may have spoiled me. I don't know. But either way, if it never happens again, it happened once, and I'm tickled to death, and I'll give her a shout-out. If anybody is looking for something new, look at the stable of writers that Robin Tidwell at Rockin' Horse Publishing has, and look at her books. They're wonderful. She is wonderful. All of the writers that she's got in her publishing company are just terrific.
Well, you make sure that she gets in touch with me, because you know I like to keep my eyes out on great authors. I don't care how they're published. You know, I'm not a snob about that. I don't care if you self-publish, if you're small press, or if you're traditionally published, whether you're a newbie or, you know, established. You know that. I met you after your first book. And so,
you let me stick my nose under the tent, and I've been grateful ever since.
Well, you know, we've been pals ever since. So, you know, I demand to know what you're writing every time. I'm so glad that you have a publisher for this book, and I'm so glad that you've had this breakthrough, Jeff. You sound so much more confident than the last few times we've talked, and I'm really, really happy for you. I am, truly. You know, I love your books anyway. They scare the crap out of me, and I guess that's a good thing. You know, that's the emotional reaction you're going for. Well, you got it with me. I have the blanket pulled up to my eyeballs, and, you know, the cats are gathered around me. So I'm, like, hanging on for dear life. My poor fat cat's looking at me thinking, don't look at me. I'm not saving your ass, you know. But that's... That's kind of where I am when I'm reading your books, because my parents were from New England, for crying out loud, and I grew up in Miami. We didn't do storytelling. You know, those New Englanders didn't do storytelling like that. So this is a whole new way of thinking. And Miami, of course, is not the South. It might be geographically. It isn't until you hit Gainesville and go north that you're actually in the South, right?
Right.
So.
Right.
Do you have a working title for your next book?
I do. In fact, somebody asked me about that today, and they had seen a partial, and I told them what the title was, and they said, well, we thought that was just something that you'd put on there so you'd know what it was. That's really the title? And I said, yeah. And the title is going to be a strange one. It's called Designate Number 34.
Say it again.
It'll be about a man that spends 18 years in solitary confinement in an experimental prison. And not like some of the books that you read, this guy actually belonged there. He was a nut job. I mean, he was a certifiable toys in the attic. And,
yeah, well, you're coming out of 18 years in solitary, you're even nuttier then.
Oh yeah, he needed to be put in there, and he did not need to be anywhere but there. So I'm having a lot of fun writing crazy.
I love
it. Yeah, somebody asked me the other day where this came from. You know, and I think they were sort of trying to go in the back door to find out if I was a little bit of a lunatic. And I did my best to assure them that I was not. That it was probably something that everybody had inside. I just found a way to let it out and get some air every once in a while.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know that you're always welcome to come back here anytime, because I love hearing your stories, and I love hearing about how your process is becoming more refined for you and your skills are being honed. And, of course, I love hearing about the new additions to your family. And so will you come
back? You have
back?
One as well.
I do.
I mean,
I have a granddaughter now who just turned 1 year old, and she's absolutely fabulous. It's amazing.
I know. I see it, and I guarantee you, just ready to eat her up with a spoon.
Oh, listen, you know, as soon as Ellie told me she was pregnant, that child was clothed for the first year of her life, you know, when she knew she was having a girl. And so before her birthday, she now is clothed for the next year of her life. So I leave the toys to the parents to go ahead and get, because my daughter is a teacher and, you know, elementary school. So she knows what her child needs. But she's just adorable. This child laughs all the time. And it's just so much fun to be around. So, yeah, it's an amazing thing. They and I love spoiling her. You know, what can I tell you? It's weird.
Well, I'm the same way. Growing up, I never was around kids much. I never had the patience for them. They always got into things and made things sticky. But the older I get, the more I like little young ones. I like playing with them. I like watching them grow. It's a lot.
You know,
of,
Jeff,
of fun.
That's us looking at our own mortality too, and thinking about, you know, what we're leaving behind. I think I think about those things more and more as the years go on, and how blessed I am, how really truly lucky I am to have a great kid and her husband and the baby, and then my brother's kids and all. So, you know, it's a good way to look back at your life, you know, to know that you have good people, good family surrounding you for sure. Come back when the new one comes out. I'll be anxious to see it. And thanks for my autographed copy, by the way. You know that stays in my special collection. That will never, ever leave. That won't leave until the time to put me in the incinerator. And then I'm taking all my books with me, so I have something to do, regardless of where I go. Whether I'm going up or down, I'm going to have books with me.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I guarantee you that signature will not make it read any better, but I'm glad you got it.
I
was tickled to death to send it to you.
I think it does. I think it makes it ever so much better. Hold on just one second while I tell everybody what's happening next week. This is really cool. Next week, John McGoran is coming on with me. He's a fabulous writer. Ward Larson, who writes some of the best thriller fiction I've ever read. And then Allison Liotta is coming on. She has a new book out that's going to blow you away. She was a federal prosecutor for sex crimes and domestic violence, and her books are all kind of sort of based on that, but the book is so good. I can't wait to talk to her about it, and she's really a fun interview too. Jeff Crawford, the book is Fields of Ghosts. Find Jeff on Facebook. He really is pretty good about responding when he's not writing, so don't be frustrated if he doesn't answer you right away, but he's pretty good about it, aren't you? You like interacting with your readers. I know that. And thank you so much for being with me. And we'll talk again soon, won't we?
Yes, ma'am. I'll come back anytime you let me.
You know, anytime you want, you're welcome here. Thank you so much, Jeff Crawford. Have a terrific weekend. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk. And thank you.
Thank you, Pam.
Good night. And listeners, thank you so much for being with me tonight. I appreciate you so much. Have just a really great weekend. It's a great weekend to read books. I hope you have fun. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.